Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Welcome on this New Year's Eve to another edition of Garden Talk. And today we welcome back John Hendrickson. John is a senior outreach specialist with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems at UW-Madison. He directs the 2011 Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, and it's designed to help you get started in small-scale vegetable production and marketing. It's a three-day school. It's going to be held Friday through Sunday, January 14, 15, and 16 on the UW-Madison campus. So it's great to have him along. We'll talk about that school, but we'll also talk with you about your garden. John has a lot of experience in gardening himself and a good background, so it's great to have him along today to talk about how to make the most of your garden in 2011. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Be great to hear from you. And John, it's great to have you with us in the studio today. Thanks for coming by.
Pleasure to be here, Larry.
And let's, before we, John in Neillsville, hold on there. We'll get to you in just a second here. I want to ask you first, though, a little about the School for Beginning Market Gardeners. Who's involved, or who should be involved in this? Who should attend?
Well, this class is designed for people who are ready to take the leap from producing producing vegetables to making a business out of it and marketing it and trying to earn some income for the household.
And does the person have to have a lot of property?
Well, with vegetables, it doesn't take a whole lot of space to grow a lot of vegetables. And I think most gardeners will know that. If you've ever accidentally planted a few too many zucchini, you know that there can be an incredible bounty from a relatively small amount of space. You know, we have people who are looking at just having a small market garden, maybe a half acre, all the way up to people who are thinking about having 5, 10, or more acres of in production.
Oh, 10 acres of vegetable garden. Sounds like
well,
a lot of work
not,
to me.
Then it's not a garden anymore.
And you do this yourself.
I do. My farm is near Waterloo, Wisconsin, Stone Circle Farm, and we have a couple acres in production.
And for people who, and we'll talk some more about this, but just to get things rolling, for people who might be interested in taking a look at, oh, maybe I could get involved in this, where do they go? Is there an online presence? Or?
Yeah, you can find our brochure for the School for Beginning Market Growers on the CIAS website, the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems website. Really, if you search in Google or another search engine for Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, you can get there really quick.
Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. I said gardeners earlier, but it's growers.
That's true.
Gardeners, too. I guess it is.
Yeah,
make a lot of difference.
Whether you call it gardeners or growers.
All right. Well, John's been waiting a while in Neillsville, so let's go to John. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. See, just a couple quick questions. My wife has a beautiful flower gardens, but we try to keep the weeds down in there, and we put down grass clippings, we put down sawdust 4 or 5 inches deep, newspapers, everything. We can't keep the weeds out of there, and we end up spending more time weeding than we should be recreationing. And my second question is tomatoes. Can I cut them up when they're ripe and put them in plastic Ziploc bags, get the air out of them, and throw them in the freezer, and will they stay good that way? And is that okay to do that? And thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much for calling.
Sure. Well, it sounds like you're on your way to at least one strategy that can be helpful to control weeds, and that is to use mulch. I'm a little surprised to hear that you're having as big an issue as you're having, given that you're mulching as thickly as you are. I would caution against putting in too much sawdust, which can bind up nutrients in the soil. So it's better to use those grass clippings, leaves, straw, hay, things like that in the garden. But really, you know, there's assuming that you're going to do it organically and you're not going to use herbicides, there's really no way getting around the ultimate weapon, which is persistence,
yeah.
Which is just being out there when the weeds are small, when they're easier to take care of, and doing it on a regular basis.
Do you mulch heavily in your... Now, this year's is an organic.
Yes, I'm certified organic on my farm.
And so you must use a lot of mulch then.
Well, I do and I don't. The drawback to mulch when you start growing at a larger scale is that if you do have a weed problem that ends up coming up through that mulch, it can be very difficult to then cultivate either with a hoe or a wheel hoe or a tractor. So once you've got that mulch down, you're committed to having it work, or if it doesn't work, then you're committed to going in and doing it by hand. So there are certainly crops that I try to use mulch on. Had great luck this past year mulching my cucumbers, usually mulch my tomatoes, things like that.
And what do you use for mulch?
I usually use straw.
You usually use straw. And there again, you have to be a little careful about the straw you pick, too.
That is correct. And I learned the hard way that you got to be especially careful with wheat straw. Otherwise, you can have a nice crop of wheat.
Oh, that would not be good. You can join in, too, as we talk about the vegetable garden for 2011 and how to make the most out of your vegetable garden. And we probably talk a little bit about flowers as well at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us too at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And John, you wanted to bring something else in here too.
Well, I wanted to answer, I believe it was John's second question, which is about freezing tomatoes.
Sorry.
Not a gardening question per se, but it is a way to get the most out of your garden if you want to preserve things and enjoy things through the wintertime. And I think freezing tomatoes is an excellent option, assuming that you have a chest freezer and have ample space to keep the tomatoes. I think it's far easier than canning. I used to can a lot of tomatoes. Now, really, the only tomatoes that I can are in the form of salsa, which my household uses a lot of. So we make sure and can a lot of salsa. But all the other paste tomatoes and stuff, well, we usually freeze the tomatoes.
Yeah, and then make the sauce afterwards.
And then make the salsa afterwards, exactly.
So what when it comes out of the freezer, what does it look like after it? I mean, it just kind of falls apart, I assume, after.
Right. You start cooking it in the pan, and it defrosts and turns into tomato mush.
But good tomato mush.
That's right.
Very good
tomato. And he mentioned dicing the tomatoes before doing it. That's not necessary. It's certainly can take the time to do that, but you can also just freeze them whole.
Let's take some more calls here. Cindy in La Crosse has a question for you. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two raised beds of strawberries that I planted last year and did not harvest any. I cut all the blooms off, but in the fall, I wasn't sure if I was supposed to cut all the greens off or not, and I didn't want to hurt the rhizome, you know, down below by the dirt level, so I just left it be. And, of course, now they're full of snow, and I'm afraid because we're having a warm spell now, and the snow melted last night, and I'm afraid that is the cold going to hurt those rhizomes down there, because I just put a sprinkle of straw over them, but I didn't put a heavy layer of straw over them.
Cindy, I'm really glad you called, because this is an issue that's going to be affecting a lot of people. Our lawn is almost cleared of snow as well in our garden area.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure a lot of people are worried about that very thing. What do you think, John?
Well, I wish I could say I had a definitive answer. I do not grow strawberries myself. I stick with the vegetables. So I would welcome anyone else out there that would wanted to call in with a definitive answer. But I believe it would be very smart for you to get out and try to mulch those strawberries before it gets. And it's supposed to get quite cold this weekend again. And we're losing the snow fast. It's amazing. Just a little bit above 32 and that snow really disappears fast.
Yeah. What kind of mulch now? I do have some old hay in the barn, or I could, I could put fabric on it, I suppose.
I would definitely go with the hay over just putting fabric on. That fabric is just going to get cemented plastered to the ground, given the wet conditions that we have right now, and then it's just going to freeze solid, and you might not even be able to pull that fabric back up.
So if you've got the old hay, I'd go that route.
All right, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, that's going to be an issue for quite a few people, not only in Iowa, as La Crosse, as cities from La Crosse, but possibly even in Iowa. Darren in Dubuque, Iowa, is up with a question. Let's go to Darren. Hi, Darren.
Hi. My question is, I'm planning on starting a garden to do some gardening with my kids this spring and summer, and I just have a home in the city, and I'm trying to question what the best way is to create a garden. If I should do a raised garden or just get a lot of dirt dumped on my backyard, and if you have any suggestions on how the best way is to get a first garden started.
Yeah, how big of a garden were you thinking about?
Well, I don't know, but I'm thinking like tomatoes, cucumbers, carrots, peppers. Not huge, but enough for, you know, a fairly large family.
Okay.
Yeah, I think raised beds are an excellent way to go. Just makes it that much easier on you and the children to work in the garden. You know, raised beds have all kinds of different benefits as well in terms of having a nice uncompacted soil environment, because you're not stepping and walking in the garden.
They look nice.
Yeah, they look nice. Exactly. if you're in an urban setting, it can blend right in with your other landscaping. There are some excellent books out there about square foot gardening, which is a way of determining how much of the different things you're going to grow and how you're going to lay them out in your garden, different crops requiring different amounts of square footage. So I would encourage you to, I'm sure your local library probably has a square foot gardening method book, and I would encourage you to pursue that.
Yeah. But a raised bed, how much soil would you have to bring in for a raised bed? Would you want it 8 inches, a foot?
8 inches is plenty.
Should be enough.
6 to 8 inches is fine. I mean, a lot of those roots, some of the roots are going to go down further than that, down into below the grass soil level in your yard. But many of the vegetables don't necessarily root that deeply.
And if you're using a raised bed, it's probably a good idea to, before you put the soil in, to kind of work up the soil that it's coming, that you're adding on top.
That is correct. You wouldn't want to just dump the soil on top of your grass sod. That grass sod is going to then be in an anaerobic environment, no air, and it's not going to decompose very well. It's just going to kind of form a mat in which the roots and things wouldn't necessarily be able to penetrate.
So get rid of the sod and then work the soil up a little bit and put on that 8 inches of topsoil.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Tom in Fenimore up next. Tom, hi.
Hi. You had a guy call in about weed control and tomatoes, and we've used a process probably the last 15 years. We used landscaping matting, and we used the ground staples to hold it down. We put that, and then we put a cut in it and put the tomatoes through it, and it really has done a job keeping down any weed problems around the tomatoes. And this stuff also allows water to penetrate through it rather slowly, but it does. It's always adequate.
And then do you pick it up at the end of the season?
We have left it down there for as much as 5 years, but some of the stuff we're getting now doesn't last that long.
Yeah. And you don't want the soil starting to build up over the top of it, because that creates issues, too.
Yeah.
All right.
And the other comment was, you know, they mentioned about sawdust. You just don't dare use sawdust, because if you get it from the sawmill, you might get some walnut dust in there, and that will kill everything.
Yeah, that is especially tomatoes. Or any Solanaceae plant, it's going to do away with. But you can, if you have, let's say you might have your own property, and it sounded like our earlier caller might have had his own supply of sawdust from around the area. So if you know what's in it, even then, it's probably a good idea, I would think, John, to let it sit for at least a year.
Yeah, or, you know, he mentioned that he was adding grass clippings. If you're adding a lot of that, you know, carbon material, which is what sawdust is, essentially carbon, if you're going to be adding a lot of carbon, you need to make sure that you're also adding a lot of nitrogen, a lot of green material, the grass clippings. You know, I know people get manure that has sawdust in it from barns. So it can be an okay product. You just got to make sure that you're not going too heavy with it. The landscape fabric that he mentioned is an excellent solution. I believe the caller was dealing with a flower bed, which, you know, given the you know, you might have flowers coming up here and there and planting them all over the place. It might be a little awkward to use the landscape fabric in a flower garden, but there's also planter's paper, paper-based mulches that you can put down and then put mulch on top of that, which can be effective. Some people just use newspapers. Yeah. So there's a lot of potential there.
Thanks a lot for calling, Tom. Appreciate your call. John Hendrickson, our guest today, Senior Outreach Specialist with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems, as we talk with him today about the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, and also talking with you and with me about how to make the most of our garden. Larry Mueller here, Rachel Owen, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking gardening today with John Hendrickson of the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems at UW-Madison. Call us with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Margaret in Eau Claire up next. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering about composting for the winter. My compost pile that I usually have outside is quite a ways away from the house, and I don't want to walk through all the snow to get there, so I'm wondering if there's a way to do it like in a metal garbage can or something just outside the door. Or...
Oh, and just let it sit until spring and then move it.
And then move it?
Yeah, John, does that work?
Well, I've never done that. I deal with the same problem. My compost, I have to wade through the drifts. Of course, they're all melting now, but I have to wade through the drifts in order to get to my compost pile as well. You know, one option that you might consider is a worm bin. I'm pretty sure I've seen the instructions for how to build one of these online. You can get one of these large Rubbermaid type containers and put screen vents, you know, cut the ends off so that there's some airflow, mm-hmm. and provide some shredded newspaper and kitchen scraps and get some, I believe they're called red wigglers, the little mm-hmm. the worms that are typically used in a worm bin. And you can keep that in your basement. And the worms will go to town.
Huh. So you can order the worms online, or?
I believe you can, or there are, you know, you might, a local gardening club, or might have there might be some people in your community that can start you off with a handful of them.
Okay, if I don't want to use worms, and I just want to leave it, would it be like, I mean, it would rot, right? And would it still be okay for... putting
on the
compost?
You can always add stuff to the compost pile. You know, the stuff is going to be... For most of the winter, it's probably going to be frozen solid. I guess it depends on whether you want to try to move that trash barrel. It might be quite heavy by the time spring rolls around in terms of moving it to your compost pile.
I'd get some bungee cords, too, and I'd bungee it.
the lid on?
I'd bungee the lid on, or the raccoons or whatever will tip it over and have a field day with it.
That's a good point, Larry.
But there's no reason why you couldn't do that. I mean, it depends, you know, how much... There may come a time in the winter where you're, oh, it's full, I'm going to have to go and, but then you're only making one trip as opposed to, you know, trip every day.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll take Annie's call next. Annie's calling from Janesville. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Happy New Year's to both of you.
To you as well.
Or to all, to listeners too. I live in the city. I have a big backyard since 95. I've been trying to turn it into all garden, no grass. I grow lots of vegetables and fruits. I've been trying to figure out how to get some manure from an Amish family. I need to put nutrients back in the ground, but large quantities, so I'd have to do it gradually. But I'm wondering how to get a hold of somebody.
Oh, with organic.
So
you're looking for organic manure, essentially.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And it would cost too much to get all those bags at
the local supply stores. Sure.
Yeah.
Well, one route would be to contact your local extension office and see if they didn't have a recommendation for you.
Oh.
They would have locally. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, might look in the newspaper and look up if there are horse stabling operations. I don't know if you're bound and determined to get it from an Amish farm or not.
Well, I figured that would be more organic. So
it could be. It certainly
horses
could be.
Horses, too. Typically, they're pastured, and they're not pastured on land that has chemicals applied to it.
That's true.
And your extension agent in that area is Mike Maddox.
Okay.
And he's also at the Janesville Rotary Garden. He has sort of a part-time appointment between halftime with the Janesville Rotary Garden and halftime with UW Extension, and he might well have ideas about where you could go to get that kind of manure.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, he wouldn't have forgiven me if I'd forgotten the name of the Janesville Rotary Gardens.
Mike's an excellent contact for her. He's a great guy. He took the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers a couple years ago, too.
Ah, cool. Well, he is a good guy. He comes on the show every so often. He's a guest here. Paul in Lodi, we turn to you next. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What can we do for you?
Well, I got a question. We really enjoy doing the tomatoes, among other things, but what we found is we've had a couple years where we'll get so many tomatoes that you can't even do it. You don't know what to do with them. And then with these last few years being so wet and cool,
yep,
you get almost nothing.
Oh, so you went from
too many to not enough?
We go for, yeah, boom and bust.
Yeah.
Well, herein lies the dilemma, and it's one of the things that we deal with in the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers, is if you're going to make a business out of this, one of the things you have to be ready for is the fact that we're, of course, dealing with nature. And
well, we're just looking at for personal use, but
right.
I mean,
yeah, but the same principles would apply.
Exactly. There's years that are good, and there's years that are bad, and you know, it kind of varies from crop to crop. Some crops are a little bit more dependable and reliable. The one that I found to be the most topsy-turvy in terms of yields from year to year is peppers. Peppers are a very finicky plant when it comes to when they're flowering and setting fruit. The conditions have to be just right in terms of temperature and moisture and everything. And, yeah, it seems like there's not a middle-of-the-road average year for peppers. It's either you've got bushels of them, or you don't have any. This last year, I didn't have any. The tomatoes, you know, I don't know how serious you want to get, but one way to get more dependable results with tomatoes is to grow them in undercover. And there are lots of companies out there selling small little greenhouse hoop house type structures that you can have even in your backyard, where then you control the temperature and the moisture and you have a much more reliable yields, which is one of the things that a lot of vegetable growers in the state are turning to in terms of growing more and more of their tomato crops under protection.
Hmm.
Well, some thought to that. I mean, we're in the country, so we can do pretty much what we want. I was thinking in terms like if there were different varieties that seemed to be more hardy or not. We've typically gone with the heirloom tomatoes because they find that even with wet weather, we don't get the blight.
Yeah.
But it's odd because we'll, you know, a couple of years, we'll just get, like I said, just a boatload of tomatoes. And then, like these last two or three years, we get nice, big, healthy plants, but hardly any fruit.
Yeah.
You know, another strategy in addition to leaning towards the heirlooms, which may have some disease resistance, and there are actually a lot of hybrid varieties that have built-in disease resistance and can be very dependable as well, which leads to a strategy of planting a number of different varieties, because in a given year, one tomato might not like how wet it is or how dry it is or how warm it is, but the other tomato variety might have an advantage. So diversifying your plantings is an excellent strategy.
Yeah, well, we do that generally because we'll get beet feeders and I'm trying to think of all the names, but we do have several different types.
It's a good strategy, but Mother Nature sometimes
wins.
I have a friend, Chuck Johnson, who bought an old boat hoist, and the boat hoist, you know, has that over, you know, hang thing, and then he made himself a greenhouse out of a boat hoist. And he'd picked the boat hoist up for a little or nothing because it was broken. And But the structure was there, and it was made a perfect greenhouse. And he gets great tomatoes in that because he can start early.
Yep, you can start early and harvest late as well.
So, well, thank you for the information. And the one thing I was going to mention is what we use for keeping weeds down is we have a lot of sand out by us. So we have good drainage, but we're kind of weak on the quality of the soil. I've been using, if you can find it, it's baled leaves.
Yeah, baled leaves.
Yeah, the nice thing is that when you pull them apart, they seem to be about an inch or two thick in mats, and then you just lay them down, and then at the end of the season, fill them right in. And
you got some organic matter in your soil. That's a good idea.
Yeah, leaves are excellent for the garden.
Yeah, so it it takes a few years to build up the soil quality, but...
It's worth it.
Yep.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. My when I had a very large garden, I also had a big lawn. And I'd run the mower over the leaves and, sort of break them up a bit. But I'd save them for the next spring, and I'd put a thick layer of leaves down. And that really worked well in the vegetable garden as a mulch. Really worked well. Let's see. Lisa in Eau Claire has a 12-by-20-foot outdoor garden and was able to grow hot peppers, but not sweet peppers. Seems odd to her. And do you have any ideas why the hot peppers grow but not the sweet peppers?
I experienced the exact same thing.
Oh.
And from year to year, and you think, I don't know, maybe it's just the word hot, but you think hot peppers, they should do better in Arizona or something than Wisconsin.
Right.
It's not the case. Hot peppers are by far more reliable than sweet peppers. I wish I could tell you why. I'm sure there's some faculty here on campus that could answer that question. But
well, it may be, as you were saying earlier, one of the reasons that we have trouble with peppers is that if you happen to get a little cold snap after those plants are out, if it comes at the wrong time, you're just not going to get flowers. And maybe the hot peppers are, even though they like a warm climate, maybe they're a little hardier against that sort of issue.
Yeah, and it actually is kind of a misconception that peppers like it really hot. They definitely like it warm, but they really don't like it especially hot. I mean, watermelons and tomatoes and things like that like it much hotter than a pepper plant does. And so actually a hot spell early in June can cause those flowers to drop off the plants as well.
Okay.
The genetics of the hot pepper plants must have a greater greater tolerance.
Lola in Richland Center, we're on to you now. Hi, Lola.
Good morning. I always enjoy your programs.
Thank you.
And I learn so much from them. I'm going to discuss the tomatoes. I just pick my tomatoes as they are, as they ripen, when I have too many, and I just wipe them off with a cloth, not a damp cloth, a dry cloth, and I just put them in the freezer that way. They fall into the empty places, and then when I'm digging for something else, I come across three or four tomatoes, and then I have them for my fresh soup or whatever I'm making. And all you need to do is put the tomato underneath the faucet, and that's, you can use either hot or cold water, and that skin will slip right off. I have done it for 50 years.
Oh, good for you.
So you don't even bother putting them in bags?
And no, you don't need to do that. And that way they fill up all the little cracks that you wouldn't get anything else into.
And they don't get freezer burn or anything in your freezer?
Nope, they're not for salads, but they're sure great in soup or chili.
Oh, I would bet. Why didn't I do that? Here I had some freezer space the last few years, and I've never done that.
A lot of people put them in ice cream pails, but that's not at all necessary. And I've never had any freezer burn.
How long will they keep?
Well, I keep some until the next crop comes.
Oh, so practically a year.
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
And I've had no problem with keeping them. And then I'd also like to talk on the raised beds. unless you have very, very poor soil, I discourage raised beds.
Now, why is that?
Well, because the roots can get into the real soil and go deeper than all that soil that you've hauled in, and you really don't know where that soil was before and where it came from and what kind of soil it is. Unless you have it tested, you don't know what to put on it. Where if you get some good chicken manure or sheep manure and put it on, work it in your garden, it's to me it's much better. I did not go to raised beds until I broke my hip and I had to.
Oh.
For some of them, like tomatoes, I wouldn't go to that for a raised bed. But radishes, where you have to get down so low, or onions, I did have radishes and onions and lettuce in raised beds last year, but that's the only thing I had in them. Now, this year, this last summer, when my helper and I cleaned up the garden and the yard and everything, we made lasagna gardens. I'm sure you've heard of those.
Yes, but talk about what you did.
That's what I'm going to try this spring and summer, are the lasagna gardens that I made last fall, to see how they're going to work. I don't know, but I'm going to give it a try.
Well, could you talk a little, John?
I'd like to hear what she's doing and what she's planning to do this year.
I have a lot of comfrey. So on the bottom, I made mine up 4 feet high so that I could work them very easily. And I put junky stuff on the bottom. And then on top of that, I put my comfrey leaves because they're the best manure you can almost get. And I have a lot of comfrey, so I had a lot of leaves. And I made them about 2 feet wide, and then as long as I wanted to make. Some of them are like 10 feet long, some are 3 feet long. It all depended on the space where I had it. And then when I am going to plant I'm going to plant tomatoes and squash. I know you think, well, squash just runs all over everywhere, and that's okay, but I don't want it to do that. So I'm going to try some squash the zucchini squash in some, and the tomatoes in some, and then the vining squash in some. I have three big zucchini or lasagna beds. So I'm not going to put radishes and wherever I put the plant, I'm going to just dig a hole in there because it has settled now, and I'll just put a lot of dirt and manure and mix that up good, and then I'll put my plant in there.
Yeah. John, what do you think?
Well, what she's talking about is a method of layering various types of materials, essentially similar to what you would do if you were building a compost pile in terms of having different types of ingredients and mm-hmm. having that set to begin to decompose and provide nutrients. So that's what she's doing. She's doing basically building a compost pile and then planting into it. So as those things decompose and release nutrients, the plants are right there to take advantage of it.
Wow. Lola, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. And we have an email from Diane, who's grown pole beans for years, and each time something eats the blossoms, any particular varieties that do better than others. She also says it looks like they're almost cut off, the blossoms. Maybe birds. She's tried covering, thinking birds, but to no avail, so it's probably not birds.
I have not had a problem with, I've not grown pole beans, but I've grown lots of beans in my day, and I've not experienced predation on the blossoms. Of course, the blossoms are edible. They're quite tasty to eat yourself. Of course, if you eat the blossom, you're not going to get a bean.
Right.
I'm not sure what might be causing that.
Well, maybe somebody else has an idea. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions or comments, or maybe you got a suggestion on the pole beans blossoms, and give us a call or email us at talk@wpr.org. Bob and Eau Claire up next. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Great.
Happy
thanks.
New Year.
To you as well.
Yeah. Hey, I have a maybe an answer for the woman who was looking to compost in the wintertime and didn't want to go to the back 40.
Yeah.
We have an old Rubbermaid compost bin. It's open in the bottom. It just sits on the ground. And it's got a lot of air ports in it. It's got a removable lid so you can throw the stuff in. And it sits in the backyard during the spring, summer, and fall, and we throw all of our household compost plus a lot of grass clippings and leaves and stuff into it. And then in the fall, anything that's left over that hasn't completely rotted, we just leave it in place. Excuse me. We move the bin and we bring it in right next to our garage on the yard side. So we've got a kind of a service door that goes out into our backyard. And we just park it right beside that door. And so there's really only one drift to negotiate. And it works out quite nicely. And so we can compost year-round.
That's a good idea. And then just in the spring, then you just move it all out?
There you go.
Yeah?
We throw everything in the wheelbarrow and move it back out there and throw it back in the bin, and that's our starter for the next year.
Yeah, we have a bin just like that, and I never thought about using it that way, but why not?
Yeah. Well, it's very portable, and it's easy
yeah.
to take off, you know, anything that's in it, even if it's full, you can pretty much get it off. And then you've just got a pile of compost that continues to cook into the fall.
That's a great idea. Thank you, Bob.
You're quite welcome, and all the best in 2011.
To you as well, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. John Hendrickson, our guest today, as we talk about the vegetable garden with him. He's senior outreach specialist with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems at UW-Madison, and he directs the 2011 Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. It's designed to help you get started in a small-scale vegetable production and marketing business. A three-day school on January 14th, 15th, and 16th on the UW-Madison campus. And we'll talk some more about that, but we'll also certainly be answering your questions about your own garden here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along here on this edition of Garden Talk. John Hendrickson, our guest, as we talk with him about what's going on in the garden, or maybe what should be going on in the garden, and also that Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. And just before we go back to the phones on this, John, you cover a lot of topics in this 3 days period.
Well, we do, and the main reason for that is if you're going to be a successful small-scale farmer, you, in essence, have to be kind of a jack-of-all-trades. You have to know about soil fertility, and you have to know about marketing, you have to know about bookkeeping, and you have to know, keep track of your expenses. You have to do, if you're going to be any scale at all, you might have employees, so you need to know about how to manage people. You need tools and equipment, so you need to know something about that. If you're going to grow in a greenhouse, you need to know about how to run a greenhouse. So there's a lot to it.
And you cover all that in mm-hmm. during the 3 days.
That's right.
And what is there? What's the cost associated with it?
It's $300 for the 3 days. It includes a noontime meal and snacks and breaks
okay.
along the way.
All right. So about $100 a day.
That's right.
You can learn a lot about getting involved in a market garden business. William in Milwaukee, we turn to you next. Hi, William.
Hello. Earlier there was a call-in that was talking about going with, like, making her vegetables 100% organic as possible.
Yeah.
Okay. There is no such thing as 100% organic vegetables or fruit. Anything that is grown outdoors, it cannot be considered organic anymore due to the fact that the bees or other insects that cross-pollinate it cannot tell the difference between an organic garden and one that's not.
Oh, Well, how do you respond to that, John?
Well, it is a fact that with pesticide drift and water running from one field to another, that you can have issues that with the transfer of compounds that might be used. There is a legal definition for organic in the United States that is followed, and so whether you believe that definition and abide by it, I guess that's your own personal choice. But there is a legal definition for what's considered organic and what's allowed and what's not allowed, and the amount of space you have to have between your field that's organic and one that's not. Farmers that are abiding by that can certainly label their products as certified organic.
If you had a field or an area that had been in, say, non-organic or kind of commercial production that way, how long would you have to wait? There is a waiting period.
It's a three-year period between previous non-organic use and having your land be allowed to be certified organic.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks, William. Dolores in Kenosha, on to you now. Hi, Dolores.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I have a comment about the peppers. My experience has been the same. And I have a raised bed, which I do like, except that you have to watch them because they dry out faster than, you know, in ground. But these I have done in the earth boxes, which are really nice for things that like heat and consistent moisture. And I've given up on bell peppers. They do nothing. I have, and yet I've grown hot peppers. I've done jalapenos, serranos, hot lemon, and I have so many. I've actually had some in the freezer so long they got freezer burnt, and I had to throw them out. We have great farmers markets around here. And you talked about freezing tomatoes, and I know our horticultural agent had that in an article in the paper here. And you trim it up, you know, you clean it up, you trim it up. And I usually cut them in quarters because they fit in the bags better. But you can make a wonderful fresh tomato soup in February with it. But someone had told me years ago, her father was a first-generation Italian gardener, and he grew everything but... She said, the peppers, she said they would, same thing, clean them up. They'd slice them in rings, freeze them on a cookie sheet, and then put them in a bag. And she said, you bring those out and throw them on a salad, and it's like they were just picked. So I've done that with peppers, and I usually put them in chunks or julienne them because I use them in Italian beef recipe I've got. And they're wonderful. The question I had was about root crops. Now, I did pretty good with some, and I'm just talking radishes, turnips, beets, things like that. I got infested. We went away for a few days, wrong time of the summer, and I got infested with knotweed. Mm. And to my thinking, I have used Roundup, but that's not going to do anything for this because they have so darn many seeds that... I'd be spraying all summer long. I don't want to do that. I really would like to just... I'm willing to let the garden go for a year or two if I have to. If there's some organic way to kill... It's not such a big thing. I could totally turn it over and bury them deep. Any good ideas on how I can get rid of this and get back to planting there again?
Well, again, the strategies that tend to work the best with weeds is persistence. And so that means getting after those weeds, continuing to pull. You know, eventually those, even though they have so many roots, eventually you're going to deplete the plant's ability to keep resprouting. Cover crops can also be an excellent way to deal with weeds. You mentioned that you'd be willing to maybe lay your garden to rest for a period of time. There are lots of different strategies to plant cover crops to smother things out. One strategy that works quite well is to plant cover crops that will grow quite densely, but maybe for a short period of time, so that you're also mixing in those cover crops with cultivations.
Mm.
So you're cultivating to get, you know, to kill, bring the roots up to the surface to dry out, and then you're planting another cover crop to smother smother the area and hopefully prevent a lot of regrowth of the weed, and then you're tilling again. So those fallow cultivations and repeated use of cover crops can be an excellent strategy.
And what cover crops would be recommended?
Well, it depends in large part on the weed and the time of the year that that weed is prevalent in the garden, because you have cool season grasses and you have warm season weeds.
Yeah.
So it in part depends on that.
Mm-hmm.
I would I've done some publications on cover crops, including one that hopefully will be coming out on cover crops for the home garden.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of in process right now. Generally speaking, it's best to stick with cover crops in the home garden that are easy to deal with your basic array of tools that you have in your garage.
Right.
There are some cover crops that really require heavy duty machinery to till and incorporate, things like winter rye, which just grows like crazy after it's, you plant it in the fall and then it overwinters and then grows like crazy in the spring. And that can be very difficult to deal with in a home garden situation. Things like oats and peas that will winter kill, in terms of planting cover crops in the summertime, buckwheat is an excellent one.
Right.
Very easy, germinates very easily, smothers an area very quickly and densely. And then the thing with buckwheat is it goes to flower quite readily, quite quickly, rather. And so you need to cut it, incorporate it quickly so you don't end up with a buckwheat weed problem in your garden. But this gets back to this notion of, repeated use of cover crops and cultivations. And you can do three rounds of buckwheat during the growing season because of how fast it grows.
So that might be something to consider, Dolores.
Well, that would also help, replenish the soil too.
That's correct.
That's exactly.
Yeah, you're not just getting after the weeds, but you're building the soil.
That's the organic way. Oh, yeah. Thank you, gentlemen.
All right, thank you very much for calling. I got an email from Mary in Duluth, Minnesota, and she says, I'd like people to consider canning rather than freezing, since once processed, there's no additional energy requirements. And there's some truth to that.
Very true. I looked into this as a graduate student, actually, in terms of the energy that was used in the food system. I was very curious about how much energy was used in production, how much was used in processing, how much was used in the distribution of food and transportation of food, and then how much was used in the home. And it was quite enlightening. In fact, the greatest amount of energy that's used and wasted is actually in the home, because our ovens are not very efficient, and we're cooking small batches as opposed to a big processor that's making large quantities of things. And it's very true that freezing is very energy intensive, because after you've got that frozen, you're running that freezer.
Yeah,
which is in part why I believe when I answer that person's questions, if they had a chest freezer already, you might as well be filling it up and making the best use of it. But it is true. And actually, even the best way in terms of energy efficiency is actually to dry food, to put it in a dehydrator.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other thing that you have with canning is you have the energy embodied in the jars and the lids and things like that. So if you're going to do a full cost accounting, dehydration is the most energy efficient means for preserving food.
Very interesting. Bob and Elroy, we go to you now. Hi, Bob.
Yes, I have some information for that gentleman from Dubuque that called about starting a garden with him and his kids and getting a fresh start. I strongly suggest that he buy a copy of the All-New Square Foot Gardening by Mel Bartholomew, because backyard gardening, where you just go out and dig up the back lawn and plant rows of radishes and rows of lettuce and rows of this, that's doomed for failure for a beginner. Just, you can buy one 16-foot 2x10 plank and make a 4x4 foot garden. The kids would be involved in buying the plank, cutting it up, putting it together, following the instructions in that book, and planting little square foot patches of vegetables. Start with one box, maybe two, and have the kids involved in measuring and building and planting these little square foot areas, and enjoy some success and some fun without weeds and all of the problems involved in digging up the lawn. You can cover it up with floating row cover to protect it from insects and harsh storms. They would have a ball, and then maybe next year build a second one or a third one, but ease into it, have a good time with it, and go at it this way, because they can have success and a lot of fun and enjoy a whole lifetime of gardening. But backyard, dig up your lawn, row gardening is a thing of the past.
Well,
square foot gardening is the new backyard gardening future.
Mel Bartholomew.
All new square foot gardening. It's a brand new issue of an earlier book.
I'm glad to hear my earlier recommendation seconded by you, and I'm glad you called in. I could not remember the name of the author when I mentioned it when I answered the call previously, so thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You are on the you're thinking right, Bob. I got to tell you that right now. Bob and Elroy has a great idea, so take a look at that book, Mel Bartholomew, and it's, what did he say the title was?
The New Square Foot Gardening.
The New Square Foot Gardening. And our guest today, John Hendrickson, Senior Outreach Specialist for the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems at the UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and great to have you listening to Garden Talk on this New Year's Eve. Larry Mueller here with my guest, John Hendrickson, Senior Outreach Specialist with the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems. He directs the 2011 Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Growers. And we'll be talking a little bit more about that school. You could still get involved. It's January 14th through the 5th, through the 16th. So it's 3 days on the UW-Madison campus. Started a small-scale vegetable production and marketing. If you're getting started in that, it's a great way to get started with that school. But we're also taking questions. I know Kevin in Baraboo has a comment about moving peppers indoors during winter. That's one of the questions. What about you? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions. We'll be back right after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Federal authorities have yet to confirm it, but in northwest Arkansas, they're calling it a tornado, and a powerful one. The suspected twister killed at least three people today in the tiny town of Cincinnati. Washington County Dispatch Manager Shannon McEwen says authorities are still trying to get a handle on the number of injuries.
There's been several injuries, and actually we're still, getting people right now that are still, they're injured. Just kind of hit and miss out there. Chicken houses that were destroyed, barn collapses, that sort of thing.
Widespread damage again reported. A tornado is also believed to have touched down in south-central Missouri. No immediate reports of injuries. Other severe winter storm alerts are posted across the Rockies and northern plains. Major roads were shut down in the Dakotas. To the west, more of the same. Today, Denver is expecting up to 7 inches of snow. It has been 5 years since Hurricane Katrina, but many people are still occupying FEMA trailers that were only intended to be temporary. Now, as WWNO's Eileen Fleming reports, the city of New Orleans is telling trailer tenants that it's time to go.
FEMA gave more than 200,000 trailers to people throughout the Gulf Coast whose homes were damaged by the hurricane and flooding. New Orleans had about 23,000 trailers dotting neighborhoods throughout the city. Many residents chose to move in the units set up outside their damaged homes while they made repairs. But officials say the weathered trailers are now becoming part of the blight it wants to remove. Residents in more than 200 trailers still parked at their property will be facing fines up to $500 a day starting January 1st. Critics say the plan hurts poor residents still struggling to pay for home repairs. The city says each case will be reviewed, but it wants the trailers gone in the next 3 months. For NPR News, I'm Eileen Fleming in New Orleans.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is beginning to receive reports of flu outbreaks. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports that this may be the start of the flu season.
The flu season can start any time from October to May. It's been underway for weeks in the United Kingdom. And now five places in the U.S. are reporting widespread incidents. Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, New York, and Virginia. The only state or territory recording no flu is Guam. Holiday season travel does a great job of moving the virus around, and the close quarters many travelers experienced over the last couple of weeks makes spread even easier. So far, 3 children have died of the flu. 3 flu strains are circulating, including the new H1N1 swine flu, which strikes younger people harder than older people. All 3 strains are included in the current vaccine. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
At last check on Wall Street, the Dow is up 9 at 11,577. This is NPR News. France is stepping up security ahead of New Year's Eve celebrations. Eleanor Beardsley reports that authorities are trying to curb the traditional New Year's car burning phenomenon.
50,000 additional gendarmes will be out in force on French streets, more than 10,000 of them in Paris. There are also hundreds of newly installed video cameras as part of a new surveillance plan. A helicopter will circle the skies of Paris, where police are expecting large crowds around the Eiffel Tower and the Champs-Élysées. Authorities are also trying to end what they say has become a destructive ritual in many cities, car burnings. The phenomenon started in the 1990s around the eastern city of Strasbourg. It has gained momentum over the years, especially in troubled suburban housing projects, where gangs often compete to see who can burn the most cars. 1,300 cars were burned last New Year's Eve. In an attempt to end the so-called car burning contest, the French Interior Minister says he won't release any figures this year for the number of cars burned. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
President Obama is applauding Ukraine for sending a portion of its enriched uranium to Russia for disposal. That's in line with a pact to prevent nuclear terrorism. Kiev voluntarily gave up the atomic weapons it received when the Soviet Union collapsed. In April, it forged a deal with Washington to give up all nuclear weapons by 2012. Not much movement in U.S. stocks. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is on pace to finish the year at its highest level since August of 2008. Last check, the Dow was up 9 at 11,578. NASDAQ down 10 at 2653. The S&P 500 may be on its way to its best December showing in 20 years. S&P up slightly at 1258. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Langloth Foundation, supporting innovation in physical and emotional healing for underserved populations at langloth.org.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Happy New Year, everybody. Larry Mueller here, and on this edition of Garden Talk, we're zeroing in on the garden. And we have a great guest for you today, John Hendrickson, Senior Outreach Specialist with the Center for Integrated Ag Systems, directing the Wisconsin School for Beginning Market Garden Growers. In 2011, in tomorrow, this is 2011, the times, or the dates, I should say, are January 14, 15, and 16 on the UW-Madison campus. And where do you go again to find more information on that, John?
Our brochure is on our website, the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems. It's www.cias.wisc.edu.
And speaking of that, we got Gary from Calvary, who said, I wanted to give a shout-out to John's Beginning Market Growers Program. This is an email. He took the program 2 years ago, and it was instrumental in becoming growers, selling at local farmers markets, which has been both successful and rewarding for he and his wife. Last year, we erected a 96-foot hoop house and look forward to using it in the coming season. Wondering if you have any advice on avoiding early blight with tomatoes in hoop houses, especially related to air circulation issues. He says we had blight with our outside crop last year, and it was disappointingly a total loss. So anything that you might have about blight?
Well, for starters, it's really wise to be careful about selecting your variety. There are varieties that will be listed in your seed catalogs as being resistant. Other strategies, you need to make sure that your hoop house is ventilated. and you have the ability to move air through that structure. A lot of hoop houses these days have the roll-up sides, so that you can get the air movement through there. You know, one of the benefits you have in the hoop house is that so many diseases are dependent on moisture to catch hold and run rampant. And with the hoop house, you can make sure that those leaves never see water. You know, you can use drip irrigation, and then of course you've got a roof overhead so that they're not getting rained on and the soil's not getting splashed up on those leaves.
Let's go to Kevin in Baraboo. Kevin, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi. I was just getting interested in your talk about peppers. A number of years ago, I got some peppers from a local grower here at on the square, and he basically said, peppers down in South America, they grow for years and years and years. So my wife and I have put them into pots, and we have them out in the back. And actually, I'm a middle school art teacher up in Adams Friendship, and I, you know, in the winter, I take the pots up there and basically continue growing them, and sometimes share them with people up there, and that's kind of fun. And I've got actually two kinds of peppers up there right now, some non-hot habaneros, and some green peppers that are actually yellow.
Oh, so yellow peppers.
Yeah, so they're sweet, and then there's hot ones. But the non-hot ones still do have a little bit of heat to them, so that, you know.
Sure. And so you start them in pots. You grow them in pots year-round.
Just keep them in pots all the time. You have to probably put some fertilizer on them twice a year. When I get back up to school in January, I'll probably be, you know, fertilizing them something. And then, again, in the summer when I bring them back outside, I'll do that again.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. A lot of the vegetable crops that we know as annuals will just keep growing and thriving if they're in the right climate, and peppers is one of those. I've not done what the caller has done, which is to grow them in pots and keep growing them. I'm curious as to how long they will – do they produce fruit year-round for you?
Oh, yeah. I've got fruit on them right now. The habaneros are some that are probably going to be ready, you know, sometime next week even. The yellow peppers, the sweet ones, are probably a ways off yet, maybe a month before those are going to be ready. And they don't grow really great in the winter, but it's just kind of fun when it's snow outside to have some fresh peppers.
That's wonderful. Yeah. I assume you have a south-facing window that you have them in?
Actually, it's an east-facing window.
Okay.
It's my classroom up at school.
Okay. Oh, but he probably gets a lot of light in there.
And we get a lot of light in through, you know, in the morning there. And our backyard is, we've got a lot of trees around here so that they're not really necessarily used to probably as much light as they would really like to have. But we do okay. And my wife and I call it our pizza garden. You know, we grow a few things out there, and she's got some herbs that we put into there, too. So it's kind of fun.
Oh, it sounds like fun. Kevin, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Appreciate it very much. Elaine from Appleton wonders if you've heard that people are using, or she's heard that people are using blowtorches for weeds, wonders if it's a good idea.
Oh, flame weeding actually has quite a bit of history, particularly on organic farms, as a weed control method. And there are tractor setups that have propane-powered flamers. And it's not – actually, I shouldn't specify that it's just organic farms, but there are commercial farms that are doing it quite successfully as well. And there are things that you can do just handheld, and there are tractor-mounted flame weeders that will – what's typically done is a bed is prepared for planting, and then you wait and have that first flush of weeds germinate, and then you run over it with that flame weeder, kill all that weed growth, and then without doing another tilling or cultivation to bring up more weed seeds to germinate, you go ahead and plant into it, and that really helps the crop get a jump on the next flush of weeds, which might be quite a while after that, after having that flaming pass.
So it works, and it can work in the home garden as well.
It certainly can.
Bill in Fairchild, Wisconsin. Oh, he says, my wife went through your Beginning Market Growers program last year, and she found it to be a great learning experience. She'd recommend it to anyone who's interested in market gardening. He says we are certified naturally grown and have approximately 2 acres in vegetable production. For philosophical reasons, we've decided not to grow Early Girl and Celebrity tomatoes this year. Any varieties you could recommend similar in terms of culture, production, and disease resistance?
I'm not intimately familiar with those tomato crops. I grow mostly cherry tomatoes on my farm, in addition to some large heirloom varieties. There is a new variety that's available through Johnny's Selected Seeds called Defiant. Now, this is an F1 hybrid, and I don't know if you're concerned about not growing hybrids or if you're just trying to avoid the Celebrity and Early Girl, which I believe those are
Monsanto's.
Those are Monsanto controlled vegetable varieties. But I would encourage you to look at Defiant. It's a smaller saladette type tomato, which might be quite similar to Celebrity.
Here we have another email from Tammy in Minnesota, who says in response to the gentleman who just called regarding freezing tomatoes, we found a much better and more flavorful way of storing them. We slow roast them and then freeze them. Works best with paste tomatoes like Roma's, but just slice them in half, cut out the pulp, place on a parchment-lined pans, insides up, and bake at 225 or 250 degrees for 5 to 7 hours. Some people toss in olive oil first, but we found you don't need to with the fresh from the garden tomatoes.
Another excellent way to do it. I know that that can be done with peppers, too. There's nothing like a nice roasted red pepper.
Yeah, she says they'll shrink by about half. Some slight browning will occur on the skin side, but let them cool, stack them in a Tupperware, and freeze them. They're perfect for soups in the winter, tossing into pastas, using on pizza. The slow roasting concentrates the flavors and sugars into yummy goodness. And it sounds good to me, too. Thanks, Tammy. Bob in Wauwatosa has a question for you. Hi, Bob.
Hello, thank you. We have a large walnut tree that dominates a good portion of our backyard. And I'm wondering two things. One, how far do we have to plant vegetables away from that tree? And two, are there any vegetables you can plant closer to it?
Well, if the roots of a black walnut extend beyond even the crown of the tree, the canopy of the tree, by several feet. So any Solanese plant, you're not going to be able to plant several feet beyond the, until you get several feet beyond the canopy.
Okay.
That's very true. I grew up in a household that had a yard with a number of walnut trees in it, and our garden was removed from that area by, I want to say, 10, 20 yards, perhaps. And we were able to get away with most vegetable crops, including tomatoes. But again, it probably wasn't the best and most ideal situation.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And there are some plants, vegetables, that will grow, I think, within the list. And UW Extension, I think, has a publication at the Learning Store website that shows the vegetables that are most destructive or that
impacted.
Are most impacted, let's put it that way. Yeah, impacted is a word, actually, by a walnut. So you might go online to the Learning Store, UW Extension Learning Store, and find that publication. It's free online. Mike in Hudson, hello to you.
Thank you, Larry, for everything, and John. The topic would be random results. I've been a master gardener for 13 years, and thank goodness it's helped me greatly, set me into different paths at the same time. And I was wondering if John had heard about healthy plant, through Acres USA or nutritional farming or Hybrix gardens, if he had any comments about that.
You know, I have heard of that, specifically the Hybrix. Hybrix is other words for sugars. And it's a method of farming so that you achieve the highest possible results in terms of the sugar content in the foods and flavor content in the foods. I do not have any direct experience with it, so I can't comment, but it's a very intriguing methodology, which essentially goes back to what most gardening methods will advocate, which is having healthy, rich, fertile soil.
Yeah.
So that your plants are then that much healthier and have or embody those nutrients and minerals to the best extent. You know, that's what the plants are programmed to do, is to gather up those nutrients and minerals in the soil and produce good food for us.
Yeah.
Excellent. They go a little farther. They use a test weight on the produce or products and bricks test to test the quality instead of just quantity and weight and looks. Just a little different avenue I found might be useful for everybody.
Yeah, sounds interesting for sure. Well,
and there are lots of websites online where you can learn more about that and where you can order the little testers to determine, get that bricks measurement.
Oh, cool. Thank you, Mike.
It does work. I've had a strawberry. I've never seen a strawberry over 8 from anybody other than myself, where I've gotten it up to 12 bricks. But when they're down at 3 bricks, a strawberry should measure at 6 to 16. It just upset me something terrible. That kind of hollow food. And, of course, their belief is that when you have food that weak, that anything will attack it. Funguses, bugs can attack it much easier. Plus, it doesn't store well. Or some of them, I think, are engineered to store well now. Just some other comments.
No.
And then can you repeat John's address again, please, when you get a minute?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, John.
Thank you.
The web address?
Please.
Yeah, it's www.cias.wisc.edu.
Do it once more.
Yep.
www.cias.wisc.edu.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. But an email from Jean in Lake Mills. Excuse me. She says, I have a small flock of chickens and cleaned their winter coop the other day. I spread about 6 wheelbarrows of the dirty bedding, shredded pine, over a new garden bed, actually on the snow, but it's melted down. And will this be broken down enough by spring not to burn crops? She just leaves it there and doesn't work it in.
I would be tempted to work that in the spring and delay your planting. It also, you know, it's definitely going to be, you know, there are issues with food safety and using manure, any type of manure, too close to planting a food crop. Now, I don't know if this is a food garden or a flower garden or what does it say in the email?
She doesn't
there?
Say.
Doesn't
no.
say. The rules for an organic farm, which I'm most familiar with, is that you need to apply manure 90 days prior to planting a crop in which the edible portion does not touch the ground. So, for example, peppers or sweet corn or something like that. And it's 120 days prior to planting and consuming a crop that of something that's going to touch the ground. So, for example, lettuce or carrots or something like that.
All right. There we go.
But I would always err on the side of caution and get the manure on well in advance and work it in so that it decomposes properly.
Margaret in Sun Prairie is going to start a raised bed chili garden, tomatoes, onions, green peppers, kidney beans, and so forth. I also use celery in my chili, she says. Is there a celery you can grow in the Midwest area or a celery substitute that works for the flavor? And wondering, celery doesn't, at least any celery I've ever grown doesn't work all that well. You certainly don't get the big stalks.
No, it's a challenging crop for this area, although it can be grown successfully in this area, and I know growers that do grow it quite successfully. One variety that you might want to try is a variety called Tango, which I believe is a little bit more tolerant of variable conditions than some of the other celery varieties out there. Celery is a plant that likes a very rich, fertile soil and plenty of moisture. So it's a crop that you're going to definitely have to make sure that you're getting water to it on a consistent basis through the growing season. Another thing you might try is I'm not sure if it's the same genus and species or not, but in the herb section of some vegetable seed catalogs, you'll find cutting celery, which does not grow the big beefy stalks, but grows smaller shoots. and that can be harvested repeatedly over the growing season.
And Scott in Appleton says Mel has a great square foot gardening website, and that would, Mel, it'd be Melinda Myers, I'm guessing, or maybe not.
Well, wasn't it Mel Bartholomew that wrote the book that was...
Mel Bartholomew. I was thinking of Melinda Myers because Melinda has a book called Square Foot Gardening. But Mel Bartholomew, absolutely. If you go to, what's the website? Squarefootgardening.com. And you can get some good information there, squarefootgardening.com. Sure, Mel Bartholomew. Melinda Myers, we sometimes call her Mel. That's why I had Mel on my brain.
Well, and it may be referring to her.
Well, and I know she knows a lot about square foot gardening. So I'd take a look at her website as well, Melinda Myers, M-E-Y-E-R-S. Angela in Winona, Minnesota, we're on to you now. Hi, Angela.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about a deep bed method that doesn't require raised beds and some of the benefits of that. And I also had a question of where to locate flowers of sulfur to lower pH in the garden. Should I start with the deep bed method?
Yeah, go ahead.
I have, if a person doesn't need the height of a raised bed, you know, for bending or so forth, I have found that the main benefit of a raised bed is that the soil gets very loose, very deep from not stepping on it. And so what I did was I made my garden into beds. I had about a 3,000 square foot garden. And I made it into beds that I could reach comfortably to the center on. And then I just walked the paths and flattened the paths in between. And then I did a rotation system. Well, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. So then I never stepped in those beds. And yeah, after about 3 years, I could go out in the spring. And, you know, I was also incorporating organic matter and this and that. And I could go out in the spring, and I could just start planting without having to turn the soil over, use a rototiller or anything, because the soil just stayed so loose. And I set up a four-year rotation. This gets into weed control in such a system. I set up a four-year rotation, and I'd had a big piece of plastic for each of the four sections because at times they would be, you know, you might have your spring crops put in but not your, you know, things that you plant in June, and that would be going to weeds. So I'd lay down a piece of plastic and and plant the other beds and then move on to that one. And some of the benefits are that the soil doesn't dry out as fast as in a raised bed, and it's easier to weed around. It's easier to weed than if you have boards that you have to weed it right up to the edge on. And you also don't have to build all of that. It gets slightly mounded, and then I would put straw in the paths make it nice and clean to work in there. And then the other thing I did was all around the edge of the garden, there was a path and then a then a narrow bed that I filled with herbs and culinary and medicinal herbs and flowers, and that all attracted beneficial insects. And then I used the four-year crop rotation and cover crops for weeds. And the other benefit is that then you can plant, as the soil gets loosened deeply and the roots can go down quickly. I mean, some plants won't go down real far, but those that do, you can plant them much closer together. You get a foliage canopy much faster, which reduces your weeding. And I found that there was some talk on cover crops already on your show, and I find that for the home or small market gardener, Elliot Coleman's book, The New Organic Grower, covers cover crops very well. Mm-hmm. And for crop rotation, I like Shep Ogden's book, Step by Step organic vegetable gardening. That is unfortunately out of print, but you can still get it on Amazon.com and probably some other places. So
there you have it. And gosh, we're out of time. You've come up with some great advice there, Angela. And John is shaking his head in agreement. Yes, it was really good. Really good advice. And thank you so much for your call. And John, thank you so much. By the way, Molly in Grand Marais, Minnesota says celeriac is a substitute for celery. Could be a substitute for celery. And back to your, to find out more about your beginning market growers school, go to, where do we go? CIAS.WISC.EDU.
Also, I couldn't let people know my phone number, 608-265-3704.
265-3704.
Correct.
Thank you, John. John Hendrickson, our guest today. Great to have him with us. And thank you for listening on this New Year's Eve on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network.